Welcome to part 2 in this episode of Nightmares of a Doctor. At the end of part 1, the USS Indianapolis had sunk to the bottom of the Pacific, taking with it nearly 300 of the crew. Led by Captain McVeigh, the survivors were cast adrift into vast open waters. They were about to find out that their nightmare was only just beginning. Welcome to Nightmares of a Doctor. The various survivors of the USS Indianapolis were drifting aimlessly through a landless expanse of open sea, which spanned over 10,000 square miles in area. Captain McVeigh found himself alone, with only his crippling guilt left for company. He floated helplessly until he came upon a ragged crew drifting in a life raft. Aboard with his men, the urgency of purpose returned to the captain. They sought out others drifting alone. They paddled towards them and hauled them aboard. Although devoid of his ship, McVeigh continued in his duty as captain, and the sailors with him relied on his authority. Having collected more drifters, soon their life raft sustained 30 souls. Captain McVeigh instructed each in the use of the signal mirror and the firing of the flares. Once adequately trained, he devised a rota, each taking turns to watch the bright sky. Sure enough, military planes soon flew overhead, but despite their best efforts, they would pass by unnoticed. The boys were disheartened, but the captain was not surprised. Many of them had nearly been drowned by the oil that formed a skin across the sea's surface, but from the relative safety of the life raft, McVeigh saw a purpose. He ordered his boys to slather themselves in the oily fluid, and they found it to serve as a makeshift sunscreen. The raft was resourceful in finding and collecting anything of value, and McVeigh took an inventory of all the boys' rations. They had cans of Spam, crackers, malted milk tablets, a first aid kit, flares, a flare gun, and a fishing kit. McVeigh himself spotted a water cask drifting on the tide. He pulled it aboard and lifted it to his lips. As the saltiness hit him, he braced his reaction. He put the cask down and smiled at his boys. He told them that the water was more or less okay, but they would save it for a time when they really needed a drink. The thought sustained them with a moment's relief. McVeigh snapped at the lookout, reminding him to keep his important responsibility. Distracted from the water cask, the boys turned away and stared purposefully at the sky. By dusk of the first day, the sky was no longer their primary concern. Hundreds of sharks were circling their raft. They were Makos, tigers, white tips and blues, the largest of which were 16 feet long. Nearby to Captain McVeigh, Lieutenant Richard Redmayne led a group of survivors fortunate to have salvaged 3 life rafts and 2 floater nets. This life-saving equipment supported 150 men. They'd spotted a plane pass overhead, but despite their best efforts, they were unable to get its attention. Their first day at sea was otherwise uneventful. Lieutenant Redmayne organized the rationing of all the available food, which was strictly supervised on one of the rafts. But despite his best efforts to maintain their resources, he didn't fail to notice a group on another raft were eating and drinking with startling frequency compared to the rest. The ringleader of this group was a man by the name of Morgan, who had taken charge of his raft. He denied the accusation that they had taken extra rations, but others noticed empty cans, which had holes punched through them in the hope that they'd sink and hide their indiscretion. Accusations were thrown, but when returned with denials, there seemed no available energy to pursue the matter further. In one of the other larger groups, the presence of the sharks was proving an increasing concern. In the gentle conditions, the visibility was excellent, and the looming shadows of the monstrous tigers and white tips was an unremitting and unsettling presence. One of the crew, John Bullard, recalls the growing impatience of the circling sharks. Amongst the debris that was scattered amongst their group, an eager shout went up amongst the boys, and one of them broke from the larger group. The target of his enthusiasm soon made itself obvious. He paddled in his life jacket towards an inviting case of potatoes. John Bullard ignored him and preserved his own strength. But in the relative quiet, he noticed that the sounds of his swimming had been silenced. John looked up, but he couldn't see the boy. Another moment passed before the surface water broke, and he saw the boy screaming helplessly at the surface. Like a bobber on a fishing line, the screaming boy's face zipped across the flat sea. His body was being chewed between a giant pair of jaws. His vanishing presence transformed into a growing pool of red that portentously oozed back towards the group. None of them could save him. They could only float and watch as their friend was consumed before their very eyes. Not far away, Dr. Haynes was nursing his friend Stan Lipsky. He was very badly burned, down to tendons and bones. Knowing he was dying, he spoke earnestly to Dr. Haynes, determined that a message would be delivered to his wife. He wanted her to know that he loved her very dearly, and as a beautiful young woman, he hoped she'd marry again. He took a long time to die. The rest of Dr. Haynes' survivors were on the verge of collapse. Their spinning life ring helped keep them organized, but herding them together proved painstaking work. Despite the tireless efforts of Captain Park and Father Conway, the boys were unknowingly scattering in all directions. They ordered the men to tie themselves by the straps of their life jackets. The strategy worked. The desperate man intuitively formed a fetal position, his arms and legs wrapping tightly around the one in front. They held their position and drifted as one. As the boys grew more settled, Captain Park bellowed out a count-off to serve as a reminder of their naval discipline and collective strength. The count began slowly, but the number grew to 400. Later in the morning, the heavy swell dropped and the sea became flat. Its twinkling surface reflected the sunlight to create an endless shifting carpet of blinding medallions. For some, the pain was unbearable. The uncompromising sunlight pierced through closed eyelids, and to blink was to cause your eyelids to scrape across the red and inflamed cornea of the eyes. Dr. Haynes ordered them to tear their clothing into strips and tie them into blindfolds. He also encouraged them to take off their shoes so that they might swim more easily. As 19-year-old Jack Miner pulled off his own shoes, he looked down and saw something flash beneath his feet. Before he could even understand what he had seen, the image was gone, and his tiring mind was distracted by the task. Most had been afloat without food, water, shelter, or sleep for over 40 hours. Of the 1,196 crew members who'd set sail 3 days earlier, about 600 now remained. Many were dying from exhaustion or drowning, while the sharks sensed their weakness and exploited the opportunity. Many were overwhelmed by the hysteria of their delirium. Some started to sip at the salty seawater, while others openly performed sexual acts upon one another. But for those still lucid, the horror of their predicament and the pain of their suffering was reaching and exceeding the capacity of many. For many still living, there was only one route out. Those still lucid looked on in disbelief as former shipmates untied their life jackets, took a single stroke forward before sinking without a word. Others paddled out from the protection of the group to patiently wait for a shark to take them down. About a mile from Captain McVeigh, Private McCoy was surviving in a cluster of rafts. The headcount on his raft had started at 17, but now dwindled at 12. McCoy stared vacantly at the empty life jacket belonging to a boy who'd slipped away in the night. his eyes refocused from the jacket at the surface to the depths far below. And in those perfect clear waters, he saw the boy, spread-eagled far away beneath the surface. McCoy had never been a particularly religious person, but he decided now to pray. He was resolved to keep living, but he was preparing to die. Up until this point, the restless sharks had been mostly feeding upon the dead. They then began concentrating on the exhausted stray swimmers who put up little of a fight. But now the sharks targeted the larger groups of men. McCoy looked out beyond the raft's edge. The huge grey fish glided easily, with perfect stillness, in ascending spirals up to the surface. Those who were naked or not fully clothed were at the greatest risk. A man nearby was slumped in his life jacket, apparently asleep. There was a sudden rush of movement, then the man was gone. McCoy waited patiently for his life jacket to emerge, but it never did. Another sailor in the water stumbled out of his sleep to return to his nightmare. He turned to his friend whose life jacket he was tied to. He gave him a shove, but his friend didn't respond. When the sailor pushed again, his friend tipped over and bobbed gently away. The sailor recoiled in abject horror. His friend's bottom half had been eaten, all the way up to the hem of his life jacket. Another sailor, Bob Gores, watched at a boy overcome by his fear. He wept as he paddled away from the group, but with no life jacket, he was soon on the verge of drowning. When the realization of his predicament brought him to his senses, he cried out for his friends as he tried to paddle back. Gores looked around at the huddle of frightened sailors, knowing that only he could save the drowning boy. But as Gores stroked towards him, he was immediately intercepted by a huge dorsal fin knifing through the surface of the water. He retreated to the group and the fin turned out in the direction of the boy. His screams for help were drowned beneath the waves. Soon the sea around them was flashing with tails and fins. The helpless boys held their discipline for a time, but their resolve soon broke when one of them was uplifted in the jaws of an enormous shark. It chewed the screaming boy as it frenzied through the surf, carrying him across the surface in an explosion of blood. These killers are honed to evolutionary perfection. Their vast killing jaws, suspended on a length of braided muscle, allow them to chew and rip away chunks of flesh, all without releasing the grip on their prey. They are capable of speeds up to 43 miles per hour, allowing them to attack in what are known as bump and bite maneuvers, where they crash into their victims, then eat them while they're stunned. The agitated sharks seem to swell with a growing confidence, targeting indiscriminately, attacking loners as well as groups. Some of the sailors vanished imperceptibly. The only reminder that they had ever been there before was their shredded life jacket erupting up to the surface. The attacks were heightened by the low light conditions, particularly at twilight and in the dawn hours. They would make their attacks, then spend their day cruising through the wounded and the dying, before returning to the living once the night had fallen. Such time spent continuously immersed in the chemistry of the sea begins to have a corrosive effect. Every splash in the face caused a small amount swallowed. Within minutes, the seawater in their stomach would be absorbed into the bloodstream, resulting in an unnatural saltiness to the blood. To counter this effect, the blood draws out fluid from the cells inhabiting the surrounding muscles, organs, and other tissues. These cells are sucked dry of all the fluid that they contain, and with nothing to replace it, the body becomes systemically dehydrated, and the delicate balance of internal chemistry begins to strain upon the body's vital organs. Dr. Haynes began to notice several of the men cupping up seawater before staring at it longingly. But Dr. Haynes was about to have another grave problem. When the body becomes dehydrated, there are various protective mechanisms that the body can enact. The kidneys, which filter out impurities from the blood, are alert to dehydration and swiftly adapt to strain through the blood while minimizing the fluid that is lost into the urine. But the most powerful mechanism available to the body is to instill the heightened sensation of thirst. That most painful perception overwhelms the conscious mind, so that all they can consider is how to acquire water. The endless expanse of crystal clear fluid around them begins to appear ever slightly appealing. The dehydrated boys, with swollen tongues and unhinged minds, begin to drink the salt water around them. At first they drank cautiously, with shameful secrecy, but soon they were gorging themselves on the poison around them, gulping down the sea in ecstatic satisfaction. Dr. Haynes watched in horror, his worst fear realized. Soon all of them would die. He went about them, striking them into submission, but many ignored him. They watched him coolly through haunted eyes, before lowering their jaws back to the sea. In some cases, it took several men to hold the thrashing boys to prevent them from drinking. But managing the hysteria caused a collective loss of expended vital energy. To Dr. Haynes's great pain, they altered their strategy. And when the madness set in and the drinking began, they simply removed them and left them to die. Had the ship gone down in colder water, the crew of the USS Indianapolis would have been spared of their suffering and rewarded instead with a death of hypothermia. In the part of the Pacific that they found themselves stranded, the temperature was warm and so kept them alive. But at night, the temperature rapidly dropped. The men grouped together, tying themselves tight. After the second full day at sea, the temperature was chilling, and the onset of delirium crept amongst the survivors. Dr. Haynes heard a scream. One of them was yelling, "There's a Jap here and he's trying to kill me." A mass hysteria descended upon the group. Knives were drawn and fighting ensued. The ones who were able to cut through the bonds that tied them together. By the following morning, many had been killed and the survivors had been scattered in every direction. They regrouped where they could, but another affliction fell upon the men. Dr. Haynes watched a group of boys formed up into a line, stroking through the water in attempted unison. When asked where they went, they earnestly replied, "Doctor, there's an island just ahead of us. One of us can go ashore at a time and you get 15 minutes sleep." All of them saw the very same thing. The promise of an island not so far away. Others amongst them had other hallucinations. Many were convinced that the sunken ship lay just below the surface, with a functional fountain of water upon the deck. Many dived down to reach that water. They came back to the surface with a look of satisfaction spread across their face. The pleasure was short-lived, as they had only been drinking seawater, and they would die shortly after. Granville Crane, a machinist mate second class, recalls many of the men crying out eagerly, "The India's down below and they're giving out fresh water and food in the galley." He watched some of them dive down before rising back up. He watched others dive into those crystal clear waters, but before they were able to rise back to the surface, he saw silent shadows dart towards his friends. In what must have been a terrible, helpless silence, he watched the monstrous sharks feed just a few feet away. Captain Park of the Marines was an athletic young man of renowned strength and determination, who at this time was still lucid enough to understand the madness afflicting his men. During this time, he dutifully worked to keep the boys from succumbing to their hallucinations. Again and again, he went after the men who paddled merrily towards the restored galleys of the Indianapolis or the island paradises brimming with fresh fruit and coconuts. His determined efforts exhausted his body, and he collapsed in the water while saving his friends. By nightfall, Captain Park and Father Conway would both be dead. The big Marine went first. Hallucinations and exhaustion finally overwhelmed his selfless determination. While trying to save others, he suddenly broke away and started swimming for the horizon. Father Conway followed shortly after. He had spent 3 days continuously keeping drowning men afloat, refusing to quit while praying with those who were dying. He too succumbed to exhaustion and delirium, babbling away in Latin and in prayer, a rousing but incoherent litany. Although his condition deteriorated, his delivery intensified. Soon he was blessing Dr. Haynes, striking him repeatedly in the face with his gestures. Dr. Haynes did nothing to stop his dear friend. He watched and waited patiently for the crazed priest to die. By now, Dr. Haynes carried well over 100 dog tags that he'd collected from the boys he'd personally buried over the previous 3 days. He could now barely lift the weight around his fist. With a final look, he released his grip on them and watched the dog tags of his men fall down into the blackness. Lieutenant Chuck Gwynn was on a routine patrol flight in his Lockheed Vetra PV-1 bomber. He'd learned from his morning flight briefing that he might see American convoys passing through his patrol sector. He was also to keep an eye out for any sign of enemy subs, but other than that, Gwynn was expecting an unremarkable patrol. At the time, he was having some technical problems with his plane's antenna, but it was when he gazed down at the endless miles of blue sea that he spotted something. The normal coloration of the ocean surface was distorted. It looked like an oil slick, which had to be leaking from something. He altered course, following the slick to the north, while beginning preparation for a bombing run, should this turn out to be a Japanese submarine. It was while cruising at about 900 feet that he spotted something else. It was a group of figures, waving and slapping at the water. He couldn't be sure if they were enemy or friendly, but despite the risk, he took his plane down to 300 feet, which allowed him to count about 30 people. As a patrol plane, Gwynn's PV-1 was loaded with emergency life rafts, casks of water, life jackets, and a sonobuoy. A sonobuoy was a one-way floating microphone used in anti-submarine warfare. Gwynn was hoping that one of the swimmers would get to it and yell out something to confirm their identity, but no response came. As he circled around, he made out 4 loosely scattered groups. Judging by their numbers, they had to have come from a major ship, but Gwynn felt certain that he would have been briefed had a US ship been sunk. Gwynn radioed his findings to the reconnaissance headquarters on nearby Peleliu, then he wagged his wings to let them know he'd seen them as he skimmed overhead. Amongst Gwynn's sightings, he had spotted Dr. Haynes' group. Dr. Haynes himself was on the edge of consciousness. When he saw life-saving equipment rain down from the sky, he could only assume that it came from the heavens. Some of them fell as little as 100 feet away. His neck was bleeding badly from his waterlogged life jacket chafing up against his neck, but with painfully slow strokes, he somehow made the distance. Many of his boys wore waterlogged life jackets, no longer fit for purpose. Each of them were sunk right up to the chin, treading furiously to keep their mouths above water. Even as Gwynn flew over their heads, some gave up and drowned. Dr. Haynes tore open the life jackets, looking for the precious cans of water he guessed would be stored there. He found plenty of cans, but every one of them had exploded on impact. Dr. Haynes knew that at this stage, his boys were hours away from death, some only minutes. Some of the boys realized the significance of the circling plane and began cheering and flapping their arms in excitement. Distracted briefly from their imminent survival, some of them drowned, even as they celebrated the prospect of being saved. Gwynn's message to HQ caused an explosion of action. Lieutenant Adrian Marks and his flight crew were next on the scene. He was flying his Catalina plane, affectionately known as Dumbo, to the position Gwyn had marked with a bright orange dye that he had generously scattered around the exhausted men. Marx's Dumbo was a large plane, designed for hunting subs and landing in smooth water. It had been packed full of life rafts, parachute flares, dye markers, rations, and of course, water. Within minutes of arriving on the terrible scene, Marx began bombing the boys with provisions. Marx was flying low at a reconnaissance altitude of just 25 feet. He had a perfect view through the clear water. He saw the stricken men, but he also saw hundreds, maybe thousands of sharks circling around them. It was approaching night, and Marx was well aware that this was when they feed. Even as he contemplated the imminent risk to them, he watched as a shark attacked a lone swimmer and dragged him underwater. That was just the start, and as the frenzy grew, so did his fear. Despite Dumbo's design to land on open water, Lieutenant Marx had never done so before. In fact, all previous attempts by members of his squadron had ended in disaster, and they had all received orders expressly prohibiting them from attempting further landings on water. But as Marx saw the men being torn apart by sharks, he knew there was only one thing he could do. He called out into his flight crew's headsets, gathering a consensus, ensuring they agreed to the risk he was taking. They all responded with a firm thumbs up. Lieutenant Marx was going in. He cut the throttle to the engines and dramatically lifted Dumbo's nose. The lumbering plane crashed down upon a wave, bouncing back 15 feet before coming down again even harder. The flight crew were preparing for the plane to blow apart. With a third huge blow, she settled furiously into the water, with seams and rivets popping and seawater streaming in. Cotton was used to plug up the gaps in the skin of the plane, and the radio men used buckets to bail out the water. They divided into groups. There were those occupied with the task of keeping Dumbo afloat, while the others determined to gather up the survivors, while the dwindling light of day signaled the nightmare that the darkness would bring. Dr. Haynes had found himself one of the dropped life rafts, but he was too weak to pull the toggle that would self-inflate the craft. He gathered his boys, and three of them together were able to release the cord. The craft inflated, and those that could clambered on board. Their first thought was water, but still there was none. After torturously removing his bulky life jacket, Dr. Haynes examined his wounds. The skin on his shoulders had been corroded by the seawater, chafed by his life jacket, and burned in the sun. The open sores oozed blood and pus freely, but there was neither time nor equipment with which he could treat them. He quickly set about helping more of his boys to get clear of the sea, but exposed in the sun, the heat soon became unbearable, and many who could returned to the sea. Dr. Haynes turned his attention to the raft's desalinating pump. His eyes and brain were barely capable of reading and applying the instructions, but he did what he could. He pumped for several hours, only to discover the water it produced was distinctly salty. In a fit of despair, he tipped the pump off the side of the raft. For the first time since the Indianapolis had been sunk, Dr. Haynes fell to pieces and freely wept in front of his boys. Not far away, Lieutenant Marx and his flight crew set about amongst the stranded. He pulled up one boy from the sea, but was immediately repulsed by what he lifted. It was only the remains of the upper half of a body. Dr. Haynes was watching from his raft close by, watching the rescue through the fading light of day. He threw himself off and clawed through the water. The effort nearly killed him, but he reached Marx's plane. He called out weakly for water and a life jacket. He pulled on the life jacket and paddled back to his raft, pushing ahead of him the cask full of water. The boys on the raft hauled him aboard. Dr. Haynes poured out a glass of the water. He downed it before swiftly pouring out another. Each of the boys' eyes were fixed upon Haynes and the fluid that he handled. He pointed to a boy and said, "This is for him." The glass was handed down the line of waiting hands. When the glass came back, Haynes refilled it and distributed it again. Each and every one of them were having to exercise incredible self-control, but such was their discipline and commitment to each other, they willingly suffered so that everyone might benefit. It was a moment that Dr. Haynes would remember for the rest of his life. As night fell upon them, the heroic rescue efforts were heavily reinforced. Powerful spotlights illuminated the scene, while planes circled up above, directing the efforts of the ships below. Once aboard the ships, many of the survivors were led to showers, where they sat on stools and were doused with diesel to separate the oil that clung to their bodies. The warm water thawed their tortured bodies, and many of them fell into fits of laughter before falling back into uncontrolled weeping. McCoy and his raft mates were the last to be saved. A ship approached the cluster of rafts before a crane lifted each of the skeletal bodies up into the safety of the ship. All except McCoy. He insisted on climbing the ladder himself, and when he reached the top, he fell to the floor, kissing the deck with tears running down his face. Men carried him to a shower, then onto a bunk, where he was spooned sips of water for over an hour. His mind and body savored every drop of the nourishing hydration. Never had anything tasted so sweet. Finally, he collapsed into an irresistible sleep, and he lay there peacefully for 20 hours. For 4.5 days, they had been adrift at sea, with no food, water, or shelter from the various forces of nature. The USS Indianapolis had set sail with 1,195 crewmen aboard. When the ship went down, 900 were set adrift. After 4.5 days, only 316 were still living. It was only when the survivors were taken ashore they were finally to learn the purpose of their mission, whose shrouds of secrecy had costed them so dearly. The USS Indianapolis had transported the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima, the first nuclear weapon ever used in combat. Temperatures at its epicenter reached 1 million degrees, and winds up to 500 miles per hour were whipped up in the blast. The unique weapon, measuring 10 feet in length and 4,400 kilograms in weight, killed 118,000 people in the immediate impact, out of the city's total population of 350,000. By the 15th of August 1945, Japan had surrendered. In the aftermath of a war that had devastated the world, Captain McVeigh flew into Washington, D.C. He was consumed by guilt for the lives of the young men who had suffered so terribly while under his command. He wrote letters to each of the bereaved families, where he tried to convey his profound sense of grief. His own punishment, he felt, would be a long life. But for Captain McVeigh, things were about to get even worse. On the 3rd of December 1945, Captain McVeigh was summoned to a court-martial. His charges were failure to order abandoned ship in a timely manner, and hazarding his ship by failing to zigzag while in hostile territory. What McVeigh didn't know was that his counsel was lacking the one piece of evidence that could have actually acquitted him. They were totally oblivious of the US intelligence acutely aware of the enemy subs patrolling the area, vital information that had been intentionally withheld, just for the purposes of lulling the enemy into a false sense of security. He was demoted 100 points in permanent rank and another 100 in temporary rank. He knew this meant he could never become an admiral, but more significant than that, his naval career was over. He would never command another ship. Ever since then, various members of the crew took it upon themselves to set up a regular survivors' reunion. McVeigh attended in 1960. He'd spent the past 15 years wondering if his crew still held him responsible, and his plane ride to Indianapolis was riddled with anxiety. When he stepped from the plane, he looked out to see his surviving crew ordered into lines, proudly saluting the arrival of their captain. At the end of their reunion, their captain's departure was met with loud cheers and deep admiration. It was the very last time any of the men would see him again. For many of the families of the lost sailors, Captain McVeigh could never be forgiven. For the rest of his life, he would receive their letters, which were born out of hate and saw him as the culprit. It is here that we meet with the beginning of this story. In the winter of 1968, Captain McVeigh had suffered enough. In his grief-stricken state, he saw no other route forward than the one that demanded that he take his own life. A form of justice came many years following the death of McVeigh. On the 12th of October 2000, Congress passed a resolution exonerating Captain Charles Butler McVeigh. It reads, "The American people should now recognize Captain McVeigh's lack of culpability for the tragic loss of the USS Indianapolis and the lives of the men who died as a result of the sinking of that vessel." In January 2020, of the 316 survivors, 10 are still living. None of the survivors ever held McVeigh responsible for what happened. And while they are still living, their minds house the memories of those remarkable events, which shall reverberate through history as one of the most extraordinary stories of endurance and suffering. Thank you for listening to this episode of Nightmares of a Doctor. Information regarding the sources used for this episode are available in the show notes. If you have any further thoughts or feedback for the show, please feel free to get in touch via our Instagram account at nightmaresofadoctor or via email nightmaresofadoctor@gmail.com.